There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I auditioned for lots of things, by the way. In fact, one they said that I didn't seem entirely clean. I read for a commercial and I said, was there any feedback? And they said, you didn't seem clean.
Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. Not a lie, the rhymes with Johnny. But here is Stage Door Johnny.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life in the theatre. And welcome to the final episode of Season 3 of SDJ. Now listen, this might be quite a short hiatus. I've got a lot of exciting guests lining up on the Stage Door Johnny runway. But look, in the vast unpredictability of the modern world, who can ever really say? Few things are stable, few things are predictable anymore. But one thing you can rely on, one eternal verity that will not let you down, is that my guest for this final episode will be both hilarious and brilliant. Not for nothing was he one of David Letterman's all-time favourites. I think he did his show sort of 30 times or something. He has been a movie star almost his entire career, as we discuss. At some length, actually. I'll come back to that later. But his life on stage is the stuff of legend, too. He's a 2-time Tony Award winner. He's still the youngest man to ever win for leading actor. His life in the theatre as New York royalty has included 5 plays by his mentor Neil Simon, including his Tony for Brighton Beach memoirs and his very first one out. Another Tony win for How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. One of the biggest and sort of most sensational theatrical hits ever seen with Mel Brooks' producers. And perhaps the culmination of his career as a stage actor in Christopher Hampton's The Philanthropist alongside an actor called Jonathan Cake in a terrible moustache and a purple deep pile velvet crotch tourniqueting suit. He is the magnificent Matthew Broderick. Now, a full confession. The first half of this does contain some theatre chat, but not exclusively. Listen, it's Matthew Broderick. You don't want to talk about Ferris Bueller and John Hughes at some length, about Sally Field, Marty Ritt, and Matthew's sort of catastrophic first big break. Listen, if you're a theatre absolutist, you can't bear any chat about the filthy cinema, perhaps you should go to Act 2, but if you are interested in one of the great lives of modern entertainment, stay tuned. Me and Matthew met in his dressing room at the Savoy Theatre in early spring of this year, 2024, where Matthew was about to perform his latest hit Neil Simon show alongside his wife, and now Olivier-nominated leading lady, the brilliant Sarah Jessica Parker. All right, here he is. Here's Act 1 of my conversation with the magnificent Matthew Broderick.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your Act 1 beginner's call. Mr. Cake and Mr. Broderick, to the stage, please. Have a great season finale. This is your beginner's call.
Matthew, thank you so much for doing this. We're in your not entirely enormous
now.
Oh, I can hear the bins out the back.
Yes,
not entirely enormous dressing room at the Savoy Theatre. And I don't know why it was the name Savoy, I think, that is so synonymous with luxury that made me feel like you'd be in a sort of dressing room the size of a football field.
Yeah.
In plush velvet.
No, it isn't.
I mean, it's not uncomfortable.
No, it's got its charm. It has a beautiful old cupboard for the costumes. Those are all original, apparently.
Is that right? You mean not the costumes?
No, but the oak wood.
Yes, beautiful.
Like most theaters, it looks great on the outside, and then you step in back of it, and it's a shithole.
Like theatre itself. You sent me a little video to try and help me find the stage door, and it was very evocative. Because you went down, you were the front of the theatre, yeah, which is also the Savoy Hotel. It looks yes, very fancy. There's a lot of polished brass.
Right.
And it looks very opulent. And then you go down a little alleyway. Yeah. Suddenly, you're faced with the recycling bins.
Yeah, that's horrible.
You're expecting to see people sort of living down there.
Yeah.
It becomes very Dickensian very quickly. But then it becomes also warm and cozy again when you showed me the stage door. And there's that little sort of beacon of...
Yes.
And I suddenly felt it from... Because you were the one making the video. I felt it from your point of view, that sense of... joy that this is my place of work.
Yes.
Is there a little bit of that?
Absolutely. I think to be allowed in the stage door is such a thrill for us in a way, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that door where people go in who actually work professionally in the theater, I used to be in that glowing light from in there.
And you're received with welcome and
yes,
a sort of uplit face.
You belong, you know?
By the stage door. Manager, keeper.
Hello, Gov.
Hello, Gov. You're back again. You own it for a small time.
Yeah.
And you are desperately separated from someone like me who has to write their name in.
Yes.
And be let in and given a pass.
Exactly. And wearing it around your neck. Yeah.
It's a bit like, isn't it? It's sort of psychologically for actors. It really is like you're in the club that you've been, you're mostly outside of your yeah, entire life.
I know. That's kind of awful, too. Yeah, and there's a romance to it. That alley, during the show, you can even hear it, are endless bottles being dumped from the recycle into the some other bin. You hear the tink 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 of the...
Which is, of course, perfect for the play you're doing, Plaza Suite.
Yeah.
Because it's about a hotel, and you're
yes,
doing it in a theater
right,
in or adjacent to...
Absolutely.
A hotel.
Yes, exactly.
So if you hear the crashing out of the empties,
mm-hmm,
it feels just like you're in a back alley outside the Plaza
yeah,
in New York.
Yeah.
We're sitting here in your dressing room, and I can't help but see a little, it looks like a page from a notebook,
mm,
and you've taped it to your mirror.
Yes.
And on it, do you mind if I read it out?
No.
It says, David Niven, Larry Oliver. Very nice handwriting, by the way.
Not mine.
I see. Maggie Smith, Vanessa Redgrave, Tony Newley, and Joan Collins,
mm-hmm,
Julie Christie, Angela Lansbury.
Yes.
Okay, would you mind explaining what that
yes,
is?
It's not the greatest story, but
okay,
the end of Act Two, the character I play starts mentioning names of famous people that he has just seen at the Oscars.
Yes.
And I had a very hard time sometimes
I see,
remembering those names. And then, since it doesn't matter that much, I would sometimes just put any name I could think of.
Which ones? Who were the ad hoc names you came up with?
David Niven I used to add just because I liked him. And I added Jason Robards because he was a friend.
Very significant person in your theatrical
yes,
history.
I don't remember who else. But then when we were doing the play here... John Benjamin Hickey.
Your director.
Got to put some English names in there because yeah, English audience, and then they'll like us, you know. So he kept trying to get me to add more British people. And then I came into my room during the play. He snuck in here and taped that up.
Which, oh,
those are
he?
Names of British stars who I am meant to try to get into this play.
Tony Newley and Joan Collins. I guess Joan Collins is still a huge star.
She is, and I do put her in occasionally.
Right.
The other night, she was at this show.
Was she?
Yes, and I knew that. So I definitely put her in.
Oh, was there a little frisson in the audience?
I heard a little bubble of giggling. Yeah, the people around her, I guess.
She didn't stand up and say, that's me, that's me.
No. But she was. She did. I saw her afterwards too. We were lucky enough to have a drink with her.
Do you know her?
Not really. I know somebody who knows her, and he took her, and brought us all together. And
how was Joan?
She was great.
Oh, she got a shout out. By
incredibly charming
from Jesse Kiplinger.
Yeah, and then she wrote me a little text on my birthday.
Did she?
Yeah,
more than I did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is your cheat sheet.
This is it.
For famous... Who's Larry Oliver?
Lawrence, I think, usually would be Olivier.
I see. Sorry.
You're kind of sitting in an angle.
I am.
Larry Oliver, that does sound good.
I like the idea that there was an Ealing comedy yeah. star called Larry Oliver, who's since passed into obscurity.
It sounds really good.
Sorry, Larry. Gosh, yes, that's amazing. I interviewed Maggie Smith's son for this podcast, Toby Stevens, who's brilliant. And he told me that when... Did you hear this story? That when Maggie Smith played Desdemona to Laurence Olivier's Othello, famously, at the National... Yes, not something you could do anymore. He had offered her a run of parts, I think, at the next season of the National that he just started. And she turned him down because she wanted to go and do a movie. And that night on stage, when he's supposed to hit her, he really hit her.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And she said, in her inimitable Maggie Smith gimlet wit way, she said, "It's the only time I've ever seen stars at the National." I mean, the way to sort of triumph over his casual domestic violence or sort of workplace violence.
What a great story.
So you've been coming in and out of Stage Doors. This is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. Tell me if delving back into your deep past is getting deeper. Tedious to you. It's getting deeper.
It's getting farther away.
You just celebrated a birthday, by the way, yesterday. Yes. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Now you're doing a play tonight. You did the play last night on your birthday too.
Yes, I did. I do it every night.
You do. Did it have a little extra zip because it was your birthday? Did you feel anything like, here I am on stage in London's glittering West End in my hit show and I'm celebrating my birthday. Life couldn't get any better.
I don't know if it was all that, it was all that great, but I do, you know... People were like, "Oh, I'm sorry you have to," because I did two shows. And people were like, "I'm sorry you have two shows on your birthday." But I was like, "Well, all things considered, to be as old as I am and have two shows and still doing it, I felt pretty grateful for it. I reserve the right to complain about it."
As you must.
All the time.
Of course.
No, I mostly, when people said, "Oh, sorry you have to do two shows on your birthday," I thought, "I'm not sorry."
Oh, that's very moving because, you know, this is all of a piece with what I was about to say, which is that coming into that stage door, you know, really has been your life from an incredibly early age. And why I ask about, are you okay delving back into your youth and your beginnings in the theatre and in entertainment generally, is because it's so storied, because you were so iconic as a young person. And I was just listening to it. Well, it's true. You know, you were the representation for a generation of moviegoers and theatregoers of what it is to be young. I mean, endlessly. You talked about, I was just listening to a podcast where you were talking about doing The Freshman, the movie The Freshman with Marlon Brando, where you said, "I'm going to play a teenager one last time."
Yeah.
I don't know how old you were when you did it.
Pretty old.
But you've been doing that extraordinary imprint of a young person, which is so burned into our sort of collective consciousness that I wonder whether that ever feels like a millstone. Now you're not that.
I don't know. Yes, it did at the time. I mean, the anybody who gets some success as a youngster or whatever age you get your successes, I think you start to realize you're not going to, you can't keep doing that. You know, you have to. So you start to think, how's my career going to transition? What about when I can't do this? What am I going to do when I'm 30? You know, you do think, I always thought that way. Uh-huh. I don't know, getting very identified with, like, you know, Ferris Bueller, who's the ultimate teen or whatever he is, you know, like a superhero in some way. You know, happy as I was about that, I was always thinking, I gotta make sure I'm acceptable as something else than that, because I won't be able to always do that.
He was the patron saint of youth, and still is. I mean, my kids love that movie.
Yeah, well,
it stands for something about being young.
It must,
in a very foundational way.
You know, I'm very happy to be part of it, but I don't at all think that's me. You know, that's John Hughes, and he tapped into something that I don't really understand, you know, but I know it's real, because now people are like, well, my kid's kid, you know, it's like, you know, they used to say, I loved your movie, and then they started to sing, I just showed my movie to your kid, and now they're like, I almost think grand. I don't know if I've ever heard somebody say my grandkids love Ferris Bueller. Maybe they have.
I bet they do.
You know, I mean, it meant a lot to a lot of people.
It still does.
Yeah.
What, just this is a total tangent, because this is supposed to be a theatre podcast, but I can't resist, because you're leaving soon, and I may not have a chance to talk to you again, ever.
No.
What strikes me about Ferris Bueller, watching it again quite recently, is how this extraordinary undertow of euphoric melancholy there is. How surprisingly slow the pace of it is. How there's so much air in it. And there's that kind of flinty grey palette of filming in Chicago.
Yeah.
And there's something underneath all that joie de vivre and all that joy of being young that is also the pain of getting older.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, The Breakfast Club, too. They weren't just fun, silly teen comedies, you know. He seemed to understand and take seriously teen angst, you know, or the very real fear of graduating high school. That's the last day for them, you know, before they get into the, you know, there's a scene on a trading floor at the Mercantile Exchange.
Oh, yeah. Of course,
you know, this pack of people just trading money, or Cameron's father who loves his car. You know, that money is about to take over.
Yeah,
that's one way to look at their lives.
That's very good, isn't it?
This is one of their last chance.
Because it was the 80s, and there was still a little bit of a kind of nonconformist idealism in them. It'd be just in the idea of being young.
Yeah,
and it's all about.
Of course, they did it in a Ferrari. I mean.
Sure. They needed some money, or somebody else's money.
Somebody's money, because you don't. I don't think you can go to Wrigley Field and sit in good seats just for free. So,
yes, that's true. That's so true. And this is another tangent. Didn't you have a tough time with John Hughes at certain points? I was reading, or was that overstated?
I don't know. It depends what you read, but some hard times. But I'll say that we kept in touch after, and. Always very friendly.
No more than the usual give and take, probably, between a leading actor and a major
I would
movie
say
maker.
About like that. I mean, maybe, you know, he could get very quiet and sullen.
Could he?
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to... He's not here to defend himself right. and say how awful I must have been. But he's not mean. He was never any of that. He just would... He could get... quiet. He could, if he thought you were not respecting him or didn't like some idea of his or didn't react the way he wanted you to or something, he would...
Did he stop directing you for several
years?
Yes,
he did. He stopped.
Give me the silent treatment.
Yeah.
Which seems a little self-defeating if he's trying to make this movie.
Yes.
But this is the politics of...
I know. We had a few of those. We had an awkward moment where... Well, I don't know which to tell you, but the one when he decided not to direct me was because this is my memory, so it may be not totally, you know, accurate, but he gave me a direction once that, like, I like when your eyes pop open wide and then go halfway, and then, you know, he told me what my face was doing, like I was an animated person, I guess.
Right.
You know, which is, now I would be like, fine, yeah, great.
Would you?
Probably.
Right.
Maybe I wouldn't. But at that age,
sure.
Still the Stanislavski, you know, internal, you know,
sure.
I thought things were real. And no, I mean, you know, maybe it's a little self-conscious.
Of course.
You know, somebody talks about what your body is doing. He wasn't really used to actors exactly.
Right.
I know he had done a bunch of movies, but he's a writer. He writes alone and edits, and, you know, he wasn't as communicative, at least in a way that I could, you know,
sure.
He made me a little self. All I did was say, it makes me a little self-conscious if you tell me that, you
right,
know.
Right.
After it happened a few times, I was like, I'm going to talk to him, and I did. I guess he took that as a me thinking he wasn't a good director or something like that. And then he decided, well, you don't need me. So he was just silent. So I would do takes. And I'd be like, what's going on? John's not, you know, I'd ask the producer. I'm not getting any feedback at all. And he was like, yeah, well, John's upset with, you know. And I had to go apologize. And, you know, we made up. He was also mad because we were looking at locations together. And he showed me this big Chagall stained glass. And he said, this is where you and Mia will be sitting when you make out, you know, when you kiss Mia, will be under this. And me, you know, having worked on the script for a while, but, you know, after a while, as an actor, you just start reading the dialogue. You stop reading all that boring words that say what's happening.
Yeah.
So I hadn't really paid attention for a while. And I said, what do you mean? When do I make out with Mia? And he was like, he couldn't believe that I was unaware of this important plot point. And it showed that I didn't give a shit about anything. So that was another time he got very sullen and angry with me. And there were a couple of others. And some of it was my fault. I should have realized that that's, or at least I should have known not to say, when does that happen? I had had a couple of successes and I wasn't, and I was just being myself, you know?
And it's perfectly legitimate not to read that stage direction. I know. They change all the time.
But he was a little paranoid, is what I guess I mean.
It sounds like he was a little scared of you in some way.
Maybe, which is nuts.
Or kind of, what's the word? Neil Simon, I'd love to talk much more about him, mm-hmm. but he sounded like he had a very interesting relationship with you too. This sense of seeing themselves through you in a way mm-hmm. and very, very invested in who you were. It speaks to you, this quality of that you had and still have, but particularly had so vividly as a young man. You know, people were in your thrall. I guess he probably wasn't to a certain extent too. Does that feel reasonable?
Maybe. I think he was also very distrustful of Hollywood. He probably was ready for me to be a difficult, you know, actor type. You know, he was from Chicago and sort of felt himself outside of kind of show business.
Right. Which is that lovely edge in his movies.
Yeah. You know, we did come from different ways of looking at acting and stuff, I guess, truthfully, and you know, in some way. Although I'm much more flexible now, you know, than when I started in a way. I also just have nothing but respect for him, you know, other than I know there are these little, I'm making it sound like he's petulant, like I had no part in it. And I'm sure I did. And also that's 10% of the experience. The other is that I could get a little germ of an idea or improvise something, and he would add three more angles and jokes to that joke brilliantly. Like he could help me along or give me the perfect idea over and over again. Mm. So it would not be fair to make it all sound like that. There was a lot where he was immediately... You know, I would put the towel on my head after the shower the way my sister always did.
Right.
He was like, keep your head like that, you know. And it would always lead to a whole routine, you know.
Right.
Like, he was extremely collaborative, too.
Did you improvise much of that?
Not really.
Just little ideas like that.
Little teeny things.
Foregrounded.
I think I pushed my hair up
in
the shower, maybe. But it was the kind of thing, then he would get the guy to come in and put more goo in it to make it even, you know, weirder. And it was 99% him, but I did make up a few things, only because I felt welcome to, you know, and because he would laugh. The ending, you know, about go home. Was made up.
Was it really?
Yeah, it wasn't in the script.
Where did
but
that
we kind of made it up together,
okay.
You know, while we were shooting. But
what a great collaboration.
Yeah, those scenes were particularly easy because there was nobody else around.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a camera. You could really try anything.
Wow.
He was like, you know what's interesting about you? You work better alone. You said I'm not good with other people.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
No. I hope not.
I hope not too. I don't think that's true. But probably he meant You weren't alone, obviously. You were with him.
Yeah.
You had, obviously, had this great bond at that point.
But he just said, you're better when there's no other actors around.
Let's go back to walking in these stage doors. So I'm just so taken by how deep in your past it is. Because you would have gone in with your dad, right? James, who was...
Way back.
You once told me, and this, I've said this before in the previous time we talked about, we talked to each other in this podcast with Sarah Jessica and with John Hickey. You said, when I asked you once about your dad, whether you liked your dad's acting, you said he was a lovely actor. And there was something about the way you said that word, used that word lovely, that was beautifully understated, but obviously had this huge depth of regard for what your dad did. And you would go to work with him when he was acting in the theater?
Sometimes, yeah. Our summers were often the way we got a trip or out of the city. He did jobs, not summer stock, but like, what would that be called? Like regional theater, you know, and he wouldn't be rotating plays every week or anything. It was a real, you know.
But you go visit him in the summer to wherever he was performing.
Yes, Stockbridge or Maryland or Chicago one year. Or I got trips that way. And I tended to be the one who would like to go to the theater. I would watch the show sometimes, but more than that, I would just hang out backstage, you know, hang out in the dressing room.
Right.
My comic book and my candy.
Do you remember a sort of frisson from being there? Or was it just a workplace?
It was a workplace, but it was, I loved the atmosphere. I liked the hot chocolate and, you know, little coffee table with the treats and how incredibly nice everybody was to me because I was like a cute kid, you know?
Yeah.
And so people are really like, oh, Matthew, here, come here. Let me show you how this works.
And isn't there something?
And I like being around my dad, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
It sounds like you did. Isn't there something also, I think, a bit more available in a magical way about being in a theatre than, say, being on set? I remember whenever I had my family on set when they were younger or we go to my wife's set, it's always happening somewhere else.
It's true.
In a tent or something.
It's
and
not
everyone's
that
talking
fun.
Very quiet and you've got to be very quiet. You're conspicuously aware of being in the way of people all the time. You've got important jobs with lifting cable across where you want to stand.
Absolutely.
But in a theatre, there's something very special, but sort of approachable.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's totally true. Yeah, and in a movie set, if you really know somebody well, they'll give you a pair of headphones so you can watch the video monitor and and hear the dialogue. And that's, but even that feels weird. And you always feel you're in the way on a movie set.
Because you are in the way.
You are in the way.
Because it's not about human beings.
It's you're even in the way when you're in it.
It's about opening your eyes, closing them again, then popping them back open.
No, I didn't know that back then.
And getting out of the way.
Yeah.
Then, when you were, am I right in saying this, 16 or 17, you acted with your dad in Horton Footplate, Valentine's Day.
Yep.
Suddenly, from being in the dressing room with him, you're in the company with him.
Absolutely true.
How was that?
Well, it was, I don't know if I told you last time. First, I got asked to be in a play when I was a kid.
You
I probably did tell you that.
You didn't. I've heard that on other things, but I'm going to pretend like I haven't.
He was doing a play in, I don't remember where, but directed by Frank Langella, by the way.
Oh, wow.
There were two kids in it. And they were like, we need two kids. Like, what about your, you have a daughter, a son and a daughter who are the right ages, you know, me and Janet. And so my father called and explained this to me. And I think I was 7, you know, that me and Janet could come start rehearsals pretty soon or something. And I, who had walked around the house saying, I'm going to be an actor in case anybody's interested, and, you know, filled out my library card with my profession as actor. As soon as somebody said, you know, okay, rehearsals in 2 weeks, you know, start packing your trunk, burst into tears.
Oh.
And I was like, and they were like, what's the matter? You don't want to do it? I was like, I don't want to do it. No, I want to.
Oh, wow.
Because I just didn't want to. And I also, the idea of sitting with grown-ups and holding a script and reading it out loud and not being a great reader, not being able to remember whatever the idea of when it went from fantasy to okay, I was ready to, I would do anything to not do it.
Did Janet want to be in it?
She was like, yeah, fine, sign me up.
Janet, who's now an Episcopal minister.
Yeah.
And so therefore is doing a little bit of acting.
Yes.
Every week in a kind of form.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite sure what the correct terminology is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she jumped right in and I believe that all the kid parts were cut.
Oh.
So I made a wise decision.
Yeah, I see. You could already read the writing on the wall.
Yeah. So anyway, that's a digression.
But you didn't burst into tears at 17.
No. By then, I was starting to act in high school in plays, and I was starting to think, gee, I'm good.
Yeah.
And
you were the wall in the Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
Peter Quince?
Is he? Or Tom Snout?
I think it's Tom Snout. I think you're right. With Kenneth Lonergan.
Yes.
Your high school friend.
As Laertes or somebody. Or,
oh, that's right. I think he was... Was he Demetrius?
Something like that.
Bold Demetrius. But he said when I interviewed him for this podcast that yours was the better part. His was a real ball ache.
That's true.
But you got great laughs. As
you know, he had to talk a lot and nobody cared about what he was saying. And I got... Wall has about six lines and everybody thinks they're hilarious.
And everyone's a killer.
Yeah.
Were you a chink? You had to make...
Yes. Such a wall as I would have you think that had through it a crannied hole or chink.
Crannied hole or chink. And presumably you made the fingers to be the chink?
Yeah. Yes, fingers. And I had this loam, this rough cast, this stone doth show. I had a stone in my other hand.
You can still recall the lines.
Well, it's one line. And I really learned it. Like, right. I learned it so well.
Was that the last time, incidentally, you did Shakespeare?
Yes, that's it.
Oh, I mean, you killed.
I know.
I cannot believe you didn't want to delve more into the
I know, parts. I do. I'm ready.
Well,
I'm ready.
I've got some parts for you.
Yeah, Lear. Maybe King Lear.
Oh, you'd be an amazing King Lear.
Yeah, I think so.
I think you should just jump straight in. You should go from Wall to Lear.
Yeah.
Nothing in between. You would have been,
I'll get
by
a
the
college
way,
student to direct it.
Hey, I've got something for you and Sarah Jessica.
Mm.
Benedict and Beatrice. Have you ever thought about that? You'd be the greatest Benedict and Beatrice ever.
That's, which one is that?
It's Much Ado About Nothing.
Sorry, yes.
I mean.
Right.
Anyway, we can, again, my commission will be small but meaningful.
All right. We'll talk about that. Be a better starting place than King Lear.
I don't think necessarily. I bet you could do King Lear.
But I think maybe
tomorrow.
It's good to jump into something a little less challenging.
Well, this one has more laughs, though. I think King Lear can be very funny, too.
Yeah.
Not that you're just...
Not when you see a terrified, sweating 62-year-old who can't really remember it.
Who can't remember he starts coming out with David Niven, Larry Oliver, Maggie Smith. Wait.
I'll say that tonight.
You should. Okay, but at 17, Valentine's Day, Horton Foote comes in. You'd had this great success with Wall.
Yes.
You were feeling your oats a little bit.
Yes.
And your dad says again, or did you just go up for an audition for this Horton Foote play? Or?
Horton Foote was a very close friend of my family.
Right.
So it was a little nepotism.
Okay.
Horton had been to our house, and he was getting ready to do Valentine's Day, and said I'd make a good Brother Vaughn, which is the son of the character that my dad was playing. And he said, come over to my house and read with me. So I just went to Horton's apartment and we sat in a room with this script on a coffee table and we just read through the whole thing.
Mm.
He didn't give me any notes or anything. He said, I remember he would always use the phrase, let's read it for sense. Just try to make sense of it. And then he cast me.
And your dad was playing your dad?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, it was hard. He was, because when I did plays in high school, he would always come and watch and give me notes and stuff, you know? And he said, well, now if we're in the play together, I can't be that, you know? I'm not going to give you any notes. You're totally on your own, just so you know. I'm not, don't look to me to, how should I do this or anything.
Mm.
I said, all right.
It's probably very smart, right? Because that would confuse the role with the director. Who was the director?
Horton.
Oh, Horton directed.
Yeah.
Okay. And also gave you some... he was giving you real respect there. You're a company member.
I think so. I think And I think he just really believed that, you know?
Yeah.
But I didn't really know what I was doing, you know? And Herbert Berghoff, who ran the school and the theater that this play was in, was sort of overseeing. Horton wasn't really a director, so Herbert was keeping his eye on it, I guess. And he did not totally fall for the magic that is me. I mean, he was, you know, why is people laughing at him? He told me, he yelled at me, not yell, but I was playing a guy in military school, you know, he's a screw up who's been sent off to, you know, reform school or something. And he said, this is, you're in military school, you're not a poet, you're not playing a poet. He would scream at me.
Wow.
I was too poetic.
Of course you were.
He made me wear a belt. And I looked at the pictures from the car, and I was like, well, they don't have belts. Put the belt on. And so I was walking around with this tight belt for no reason.
And your dad stayed out of all that when he's shouting at you, put the belt on.
Yeah. Everything he said sounded like he was shouting at you, but right. It was just because he was Teutonic. German or, you know. Austrian or wherever he was.
Had a certain clipped authority.
Yeah, and his age, and it just, everything seemed like,
right,
get in the ditch now, you know? But he was a very lefty great man. I shouldn't call him any kind of fascist. He was not.
Some more backtracking.
No, he was a communist.
Of course, you know. But to a 17-year-old, it can be very intimidating. Yes, of course. It's just
absolutely.
But so what was it like acting with your dad?
It was good. It was brief. I never felt fully comfortable in the role, you know, but I had little moments that I liked, and my father would be, a lot of it was him snapping at me. Brother, stop that. But, you know, the father and the son are always clashing.
And wasn't he Southern in that?
Yeah, we were all a Southern family. We're all doing these Southern accents.
Wow.
And, you know, my father would yell at me in a Southern accent, which just seemed totally, you know, I was like, come on, you don't talk like that.
And did you have problems distancing, you know, thinking of this guy as
I was like, what are you wearing that silly outfit, you fool? You know?
Was that hard for him? Did he get cross about it?
I don't think so, but I think we never had enough time to get used to that.
Right.
That new relationship or something. I wish I'd had more. I was 17.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so I got to be in the dressing room with all the men, you know.
Right.
And I heard a lot of, you know.
Of course you did.
Filthy jokes and things, and it was very exciting.
Yeah, smell of
musk. It was much less, was not the way I had remembered those summers as a lad.
Right.
You know, they were a little rougher back there.
Different level of experience you were suddenly admitted to. Yeah. It's like a sort of youthful prodigy suddenly playing in the men's soccer team or something. Yeah. You know, like, you got to grow up.
Yeah.
Well, can I fast forward a little bit? Because I know you had this extraordinary time then where you got cast in a movie with Sally Field. I don't really want to rush past this because it's so kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But I do want to get to... I hope you don't mind telling this again. The first fateful time you met Neil Simon.
Oh, yeah.
And that day.
Yeah.
And your dad's reaction to that, just because it's so extraordinary. Should we jump forward to that?
Yeah, whatever you... It's your show, as
you
say.
It is, isn't it? I don't really know what to do. No, let's... I'm also aware that I don't want to take endless time until you've got to get dressed for the show this evening.
Oh, no, I've got time. Don't worry.
All right, well, let's quickly do that. So you start off as an actor, you start off as a professional actor, you're trying to get gigs, and then suddenly you do. You get this amazing thing. Well, you should tell this story.
Brighton Beach, are we talking
about? No, can we go to the Sally Field movie? Just do that quickly?
Yes, yes.
Because what an extraordinary thing that is.
Yes, it is extraordinary. I do my play with Dad at HB Studio, which goes okay, but nobody's like, God, you really belong... As an actor, really. I have an Austrian who does not think I should be an actor, whose name is over the title at the acting school in New York.
Oh, by it
the
way. Is?
Yeah, and he's just clearly doesn't think I've got what it takes. Right. And But I keep doing plays at high school where I'm getting better at it and getting nice parts. And then just because this is funny, I'm sure you have a similar thing. You know, somebody in the class, his mother was a casting director,
that's,
you know,
right.
Barbara Clayman, I think that's her name. I think she asked the director of the plays at our high school, you know, can you send over some young people, you know, for auditions once in a while. And somehow I started to get a few auditions just out of school. And that somehow led to some sort of and my agent, the agency was named Fifi Oscard.
Fifi?
Yeah.
Fifi Oscard.
Fifi Oscard.
Oscard.
Yeah.
Fifi
Which is pretty well known.
Was it?
I think it might have been, but I just liked to say that name.
Sure.
And her name was Fifi Oscard, but I was not. I had an underling, you know.
So you landed representation with Fifi Oscard.
I did, with that agency.
Cool.
Out of high school. I think I had gotten that already. Yeah, anyway, somehow I end up auditioning for... I auditioned for lots of things, by the way, and didn't get anything.
Right.
In fact, one they said that I didn't seem entirely clean. I read for a commercial and I said, was there any feedback? And they said, you know, your hair, you didn't seem clean. So,
isn't that what they're looking for?
I guess so. The agent said, I'm going to help you. And he took me and we bought some designer jeans things like that to make me look better.
Teenagers are supposed to be slightly filthy.
Was my Upper West Side filth right. didn't translate to
right.
bubble yum.
Wait, I thought you were in the village at this point.
Yeah, but I went to high school on the Upper West Side,
so
all my friends, we all bought filthy clothing and,
right.
you know,
got dressing
wandered
down.
Around Central Park. Anyway, I'm sorry if I'm being lengthy.
You're so not.
Yeah.
No, so you flunk out from Bubble Yum. Bubble Yum doesn't want you.
No.
But
don't.
Then you then, audition.
Somehow I auditioned for a movie called No Small Affair. Somehow I make it all the way to Marty Ritt, who's directing it.
Yeah, who directed Cool Hand Luke.
Yes, and Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Yes.
Norma Ray.
Yeah. Great hard-boiled
yes.
kind of 60s, 70s legend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very tough, rugged guy. He wore like a siren suit or what's that thing called? They wear the pants and the shirt or one thing, you know, like Churchill wore.
Suit?
I think you called it a siren suit. You know, it's just zip up in it.
Oh, like a flying...
Kind of like that,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. But made for him in Beverly Hills.
Jumpsuit.
Yeah, kind of a jumpsuit he
wow.
wore. I guess he must have liked me. He liked me enough that I got to read finally with Sally Field, you know. Went to the Sherry Netherlands Hotel.
Yeah.
Went upstairs. There was another actor there reading from my part. And the scene took place that the guy was... that I was playing was in his pajamas with an overcoat. He'd gone to school in his pajamas with a coat.
Perfect for the filthy
yes.
teenager.
But this guy was in pajamas. And I was like, well, oh, fuck that. This guy's in pajamas. I didn't think of that.
He's got the whole hog.
Yeah, he's in his freaking whole costume. And but I read again my reading I had now done several times. And I do remember overhearing... I heard Sally Field say, yeah, he's perfect. He trips all over himself.
Meaning the reading or physically?
I don't know.
Maybe both.
Yeah. She just said, oh, yeah, he's great. He's just a total mess or something like that.
Right.
Like, I was accidentally good. But it was, you know, I passed. I got cast.
In a huge Marty Ritt movie.
Yeah, and I'm leaving out something, which is I had to go to Los Angeles and do a screen test.
Oh, yeah.
By myself.
Shit.
I think almost my first time on my own on a plane and in a hotel at the Universal Hotel, you know,
wow.
the one at, right on Universal.
Yes.
But the old one that was a little smaller, but I thought was the fanciest thing I'd ever been in my life.
Wow.
Went into a studio building and was given a costume and did a scene, not with Marty Ritt, some other director directing these.
Huh.
I got there and Griffin O'Neill. Ryan O'Neill's son was also auditioning for my part. I was like, well, fuck, Griffin O'Neill. I'm not going to beat out an O'Neill, man.
He better not be in
Come
his pajamas.
On. Yeah. So he did the scene, and he was all charming and funny, you know, and I did my self-conscious self scene, and I can't remember who the third one was. Other some other professional actor, and I was like, oh crap, you know it. And I lost my, and I kept all my receipts because we're like, we'll pay you back for anything you eat or whatever while you're in Los Angeles. So I kept all my little,
sure,
you know. And I lost the little bag of receipts. I was like, I lost them. I'm like, that's okay. It's all right. Here's $200, whatever it is. And
he's a mess.
Yeah,
he
I really was
all
a
over
mess.
Himself.
Yeah, I was, though, I guess.
Right.
But sure enough, a week or so later, my mom calls and says, they just call you. You got the part.
Amazing.
And I was over the moon, and I couldn't believe my good fortune. I thought it was a brilliant script, great part. It was really the lead.
Yeah.
And they had just done Norma Rae together.
Right.
So it was like, this was like Academy. Massive. I was basically began working on my Academy Award acceptance speech a few days after being cast.
Right.
You know, I knew it was possible I wouldn't win it, but I thought I should cap something.
You should definitely have something in your back pocket.
Yeah, just cap something a little, right. Give a little thought to it.
Good.
And I rehearsed for a while, and we were all got along, I thought. And then we started shooting, and I think we shot 2 weeks, or maybe a little less than that. I started to notice a little tension on the set with Marty, and a doctor came. Marty was getting his blood pressure checked all the time, and the atmosphere got a little not great. And then I went to Central Park to shoot some scene, and I put on my costume. They were like, going to have a little delay. Just hang out. Then I was like, I started playing catch or with a football with some of the crew people. And they were like, change your shirt, you know. Put your own shirt on. Don't wear your costume shirt when you're like, okay, I put on my own shirt. I was like, should I be putting the costume shirt on? Like, no, you're okay. And a few hours pass. And they say, we're going home. Today is canceled. And we'll call you about tomorrow's call. So I go home, and they say, no, we're not shooting tomorrow either. Maybe that goes on for a day or two. And I finally get a call from my agent that says, are you sitting down? I said, yeah. And he said, it's over. The movie's over. Grab a beer. We'll get something else.
And why? Was it Marty's health?
Marty's health. Yes, it was. It ended up being like the biggest insurance settlement on a movie
really?
Up to that date. It was in the paper even.
And you never went back to it once he was well? And it had nothing to do with you, right?
Or did no, it? Except I always felt and still feel they weren't thrilled with what they were getting.
Gosh.
I mean, I was not privy to any of that, but I had no feeling of, oh, God, we've got to get somebody else because this is so good. My impression, and this is just my impression, is Sally was happy to be away from it.
Gosh, I wonder if that has any basis in truth or whether that's you...
I have no idea.
...being
hard
on yourself.
Yeah. She wrote me a really sweet letter.
So what a crushing thing. You've gone from
practicing
your Oscar acceptance speech in the bath...
Exactly.
...and being the lead in a movie and playing catch in Central Park with the crew before continuing your frictionless... journey to the podium.
And all your friends jealous of you because now you're a huge movie star.
Yeah, to nothing and going back to being unemployed and going back to bubblegum adverts. Trying to get them.
It sounds like a fun story now, but there was no feeling that I'm going to get another one. The feeling was, do I now have to go to college or something? You know, this is... And I got very depressed. I didn't...
Did you?
Yeah, I basically slept for a few months.
Huh. How was your dad? Was he helpful?
My memory of my dad was that he was a little... didn't know what to do with me, you know? Yeah. He was... I think he was concerned about me and kind of quiet. I don't think he knew what to make of me. My mom was like, you know, you've got to keep going and you have to... I don't know. She said, stop. Don't smoke pot. I was smoking pot. And she said, this is not the time for that. You need your whole mind to... get through this and, you know, this is not the time to disappear like that or something. I remember that. I don't know. I started dating a girl I liked and I gradually got myself going, you know? And, but I finally, I'm doing an audition for Summer Stock I auditioned for a couple of movies and they were just like, get out. You know, I went from the guy who's in that Sally Field movie to the guy who got dumped from the Sally Field, you know, it's worse than nothing.
Shit.
You're not even able to just walk in as a, you know.
And you're still, what are you, 17, 18?
I think I'm 19 at this point.
19. And moved on to the ripe age of 19.
I read for movies and don't even get callbacks. Then I read for House of Blue Leaves they're going to do in Summerstock.
Which your dad had, had a great triumph.
Great success.
Joe Gwyer play.
Yeah, which I always loved that play. And I was like, oh, wow, that would be nice. Even though it's just Summerstock and it's just 2 weeks or whatever. I love that part. And I really worked on it, you know. Mm. And I go to the office to read for it. And I get about a paragraph and a half through this monologue that the son has, you know, this lunatic who's going to blow up the Pope. And they're like, thanks. And I was like, well, I just started. And they were like, no, that's cool. So I was like, wow, I can't even get myself to the end of an audition of a Summerstock show. That's how bad this is.
Oh, man.
And that crushed me for some reason. I went out in the street and I was just like, I got to think of something else to do. This is...
You've already been up the mountain. And now you're on a tin tray going all the way back down.
I was just like...
And in a play that meant so much to your family.
And it's not even worth getting, you know... I had another one like that when I read for The Outsiders, the movie.
Right.
And the producer, the second I started reading it, he was like, oh, he was just so bored. I could not stop looking at him like... He was just like, oh, I can't even sit down. I can't sit still. This is, oh, God, stop it, stop it. And they stopped me. So that was about the same time.
We have to get to the triumphs. Okay, we really do. Okie dokie, that's Lights Down on Act 1 of my chat with Matthew Broderick. Please join me for Act 2. Really, you should. Honestly, because we do get to the triumphs, and they are amazing, amazing to hear about. Some of the stuff that's happened in Matthew's life is really the stuff of legend. It's been repeated a lot, but it bears repeating. Come and listen to Matthew talk about getting pulled out of depression by a play by an unknown writer called Harvey Fierstein, doing things his own way when he was a young actor, and the incredible story of how his life changed forever on one day, and the sadness underneath it. We talk about the last conversation he ever had with his father, wonderful actor James Broderick, how his dad's example revisits him on stage, why he sometimes drives directors mad, why Nathan Lane thinks he's like the Warner Brothers frog, and the lifelong pressure on him to be funny, his love for Neil Simon, the failure that seems to always await these great titans of American theatre, the roller coaster of living his life almost exclusively on Broadway, and holding Robert De Niro's coat while he attacks another famous New Yorker. And finally, why theatre still matters. Come back and join me for that conversation. Really, he's worth it.
Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. Not a lie, the rhymes with Johnny. But here is stage door Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony. Sees plays sad and funny. That's stage, stage door Johnny. Stage, stage, stage door Johnny. He knows that there's no money. Being stage, stage door.